and he was waiting for her to come around and make it a reality. Seeing it as his only hope for a good life, he continued to show her that he was a better person than he used to be. Much better. More alive. At some point, his development as a human being, and the ways it showed in his behavior with other people, started to make him feel valuable, and with that came heavier responsibilities. His brother suffered a heartbreak, and he made sure he was available to talk and help him through it. In different ways, big and small, he found himself feeling of use to his family. He was the best man at his brother's wedding. She was there, glowing with her love for him. And somehow they both realized, mercifully, that their separation had run its course. They were both grown now, more equipped to handle the world together. He had stopped being selfish. She had figured out who she was. The time apart had done them good, but they were ready to begin their lives together. Together, they suffered heartache, greater than any they had caused each other in their early years. And sometimes they didn't know if they could go on. On the loneliest day of all, when he packed up the room of their lost child, he wondered if he was being punished, if his past sins were the reasons why they had to deal with such a loss. The day his first child was born, so was he, reborn, alive again. He had come such a long way, and he had changed. Reaching both a deeper and a higher level of love and understanding became possible for him. The little girl's fingers were small, but she had wrapped them around his heart. He watched the girl he had loved for years turn into a woman, and then a mother to his child. There was nothing more beautiful than that. Until she became a mum a second time, to their little boy. As their children grew older, this new man and his woman, they somehow felt younger, falling in love all over again each day. He felt so lucky, so gifted, so tremendously proud of the life they built together. He couldn't believe what a lucky bastard he was.
Zed.
Every novel has its own take on the romantic hero. Most novels use that classic trope that we've all grown tired of, the love triangle. Wickham lied about Darcy's father to gain Elizabeth's affections. Jay Gatsby wined and dined Daisy Buchanan, offering her a life her husband, Tom, couldn't. Linton was the safe choice of my favourite heroine, Catherine Earnshaw, who chose him over a life of destructive passion with Heathcliff. Even a tan and buff werewolf boy tried to win the ever-so-witty Bella Swan's heart over that sparkly ancient vampire lover dude. It's been done over and over again, and since he'd lived this through story after story, he thought it laughable when he found himself in his own real, actual love triangle. In his own story, the bad boy turned wannabe saint with daddy issues tries to keep the stubborn, innocent virgin away from the trendy and emotional boy who wants to save the flowers and the planet all in a day's work. The classics end with most of the aforementioned characters' deaths, or the birth of half-vampire babies, but they all have a common theme. One of the two men never stands a chance, and when it came to his relationship with her, he didn't know if how much she cared for him would mean he would win out in the end. Still, they deserve props, the other guys who get back out into the game, after losing to the obvious suitor.
Another party. Another overcrowded party where everyone does the same shit on a different day. Drinks are poured into red cups and the music blasts from room after room. Every person I pass as I walk down the hallway looks even more bored than the last, so I find it odd that this year's kickoff party is much more crowded than last year's. Where do all the people come from? Has everyone become so bored with themselves that they cling to a large group of other people pretending to have amazing social lives? I'm beginning to see that's all college is. Washington is very different from where I grew up in Florida, but colleges seem to be the same everywhere you go. I need to piss, I complain to the air as I lean against the wall next to the bathroom door. A few moments later, a petite girl with blonde, shoulder-length hair steps out of the bathroom. Her gaze turns down toward the floor when she walks past me. She's wearing a long-sleeved shirt that extends down to hug the curves of her hips perfectly, despite her loose, even baggy jeans. Excuse me, she says, and smiles at the carpeted floor as she maneuvers past me and down the hall. I step into the bathroom and close the door. The small space smells like artificial vanilla spray. It's quite disorienting, so I piss quickly, wash my hands, and open the door, and step into a crowd of girls. One of them looks me up and down, her eyes widening as she takes in my features. I can almost read her mind. She opens her mouth to speak, but when I look over her head, the blonde girl with the killer hips is standing at the top of the stairs. I watch as she goes to grab something from her back pocket, but coming up empty, she licks her lips and rolls her eyes. I can feel her attitude from here. I had made it a point not to look for anyone for a while after the Tessa thing, but I find myself moving down the hallway toward the blonde. I'm not looking for anything serious, but I could use a decent conversation at this point. As I near the top of the staircase, her small hand wraps around the metal post in a very delicate manner. I take a few steps closer to look at her, and she descends the stairs slowly and cautiously, even though she's wearing sneakers. Her hair is thick, covering half of her back. I watch as her eyes scan the crowd. She's aware of her surroundings. I can tell by the way she rests her eyes on every face she sees. Is she looking for someone? I watch her teeth pull in her top lip and decide to approach her. Her jeans are rolled at the bottom, and I can make out the shape of a star near her ankle. Are you looking for someone? I ask her. When she turns to face me, her brown eyes are big, nearly too big for her face, which makes her seem slightly terrified. I was looking for my friends, but I think they've left. She frowns. Oh, do you want me to help you find them? I offer. Continuing to look around the room, she reaches past my face and lifts a baseball cap off a passing guy. He grumbles and she smiles, only slightly embarrassed and somewhat desperate seeming. I look at her, wondering why she did that. My friend John is wearing a cap too, she explains. I can't tell if she's timid or aggressive yet, but I want to find out. Can't you call them? I ask. No, my phone's in my friend's purse, she says with a sigh. I didn't want to have to bring one. I knew I shouldn't have come here. Parties aren't my thing. Her voice grows louder, and she begins to gesture with her hands. And yet Macy begged and begged. It will be fun, she said. We'll only stay for an hour, she said. With a little huff, her nose crinkles up, and I bite down on my bottom lip to keep from laughing. She flushes, embarrassed. What? Nothing, I lie. She's pretty damn cute. Do you want a drink or something? I don't drink often, she says softly. Often or at all? Sometimes, but definitely not at crowded parties with a bunch of strangers. Well, I guess that makes sense. I smile, letting her know that I find it kind of cool that she's not feeling the need to get wasted like the rest of the girls here. Or the boys, for that matter. It's not like I can't have fun without being trashed. Okay, I nod, finding her more attractive by the second. Well, I can get you some water or pop, and you can hang out with me and my friends until you find yours. I'm not sure. She looks around the living room full of strangers. I don't know anyone, and parties like this are usually pretty shady. Her gaze moves to two drunk guys circling a group of freshman girls in small dresses. She's got a point. Nate waves at me from across the room, and I look at this intriguing girl once more. Well, if you decide you don't want to stand here alone, you're more than welcome to join us over there. I point toward the group and watch her eyes widen as she takes in the 100 or so tattoos among the lot of us. They're nicer than they look, I tease. When she smiles uncertainly, I add, well, some of them anyway. She surprises me by barking out a little laugh and then following me over to my group of friends. Tristan stands up, allowing her to sit on the couch, and she politely thanks him. I haven't seen him too much lately, but I'm glad he's back from Louisiana, single and officially done with Steph's bullshit. Here's to the last year of this college bullshit. He raises his cup and taps Logan's. Molly joins in and adjusts herself on his lap. Ugh, not for me. I still have two more, Nate complains. The girl he's been seeing, Brianna, I think, rolls her eyes, mutters what I think is a playful drama queen, and grabs his cup to take a drink. I should have gone to a trade school. He tilts his head back, and the girl watches him in amusement. College fucking blows. I told you should have taken that apprenticeship at the tattoo shop, she scolds him. He rolls his eyes and tugs at the tiny strap holding her shirt on one of her shoulders. Half of her deep brown skin is showing, but I sure as hell don't mind. I'm still thinking about it, he tells her. Honestly, it sounds like a decent play since he's having such a hard time finishing college. Anyway, enough of this boring career planning shit. Who's this? Molly points to the girl I met in the hallway. This is... I look at her for help. I forgot to ask her damn name.
Therese, she says,
and I get a tiny hint of an accent I hadn't noticed before. Damn.
You gotta be shitting me,
Molly laughs, leaning against Logan. Nice name, Jace smirks, licking along the edges of the rolling paper in his hands.
Wanna play a game, Therese?
Molly says with a tone I know.
Truth or dare?
She looks to me and I shake my head. No, no one wants to play that shit, I say, glaring at Molly. Therese is clueless and looks anxious and slightly uncomfortable. Oh, come on. I bet it would be fun, Jace says. Molly nods along.
Yeah, from the looks of her, maybe you could win.
Logan reaches up and covers his girlfriend's mouth. I still can't believe these two are together. Cut it out, he says to her. She rolls her eyes but stays quiet once his hand moves from her big mouth. I'm not having any part in a repeat of last year. That was too much drama. Logan kisses Molly's bare shoulder, and she smiles, for real this time, looking far less evil while doing so. Therese looks at me with a wrinkled brow, then at everyone else and their suddenly weird energy.
What was last year?
She asks. Nothing, I proclaim, and look at my friends, hoping they'll keep their mouths closed. I just met this girl. It's too early for her to be bombarded with this crap.
This guy named Hard...
Molly just can't keep her mouth closed. We aren't going to talk about Hesse anymore, Logan groans. They're like that reality show couple that no one was supposed to mention.
What the fuck is a Hesse?
Nate's girl asks. Molly proudly raises her hand. I came up with it, she practically shouts. I get full credit for that shit. I named those crazy fucks and I expect an invite to their wedding. She laughs. Her hair is a washed-out pink. It's faded a lot, and she hasn't dyed it in a while. It's mostly blonde now, and in an elven haircut. They aren't getting married, I snap at her. I'm so tired of hearing about those two. I'm tired of seeing Tessa's posts on Facebook. She's so happy in New York. Harden's so happy. Everyone is so damn happy. Yay for them.
Not right now. But I would bet money on that shit, she smiles. And I would win.
She's drawn circles around her eyes with black pencil, and when she winks at me, she looks like a cat. Logan adds salt to my wound by nodding sagely to this. Like it's so obvious to everyone. Molly waves her hand for silence among the group.
Anyway, before you all came, we were reliving the grand tale of Zed's ex-girlfriend.
Wasn't my girlfriend, I say through gritted teeth. Damn, someone says. Jace, maybe?
Well,
Therese stands to her feet and awkwardly cracks her knuckles.
This is when I leave.
She smiles hesitantly and walks away. I must have a pained or annoyed or angry expression. I felt all of those things. Because Logan pipes up, You may as well let her go. You're only going to gain another enemy. She probably has a boyfriend who'll slash the tires on your truck. Apparently, my friends have all decided they'll give me shit all week about my history of expensive mistakes. This expectation that my dating life will always be one disaster after another deflates my anger a little bit. I don't have the energy to be mad, really, when it's always the same. I didn't know that chick was engaged, and I'm pretty sure it was her, not her fiancé, that did that shit, I say, and cringe when I remember what Jonas Soto did to my car. That dude should not be able to hold a professor position here. Total nutcase. Nate shrugs, taking a swig of his drink. Stop sleeping with random chicks, then. That was over a year ago. And how was I supposed to know that her fiancé was going to be a professor here? That whole weekend was a disaster. If I'd known the chick was at the club for her own bachelorette party, I wouldn't have gone home with her. I mean, there's a reason tradition dictates they wear those tacky feather boas and fake tiaras and that sash that reads bachelorette or something. It's like a fair warning label so that guys don't do something stupid. Or she doesn't do something stupid. The sash is like the first thing you'd have to take off, so it being there is a big reminder to her that, oh yeah, she's getting married. In this case, the very next day. It was just my luck that the only time in my life I had a one-night stand, this was the result. I may have led my friends to believe a generally exaggerated version of my sex life, but they don't need to know that. The guy was cool, cooler than I would have been, until he tried to get me removed from the science program and fought to keep Hardin from being expelled. No one seemed to question why a young professor would take the side of a troublemaker he doesn't even know. That was bullshit, but at the end of the day, I'm glad Hardin wasn't expelled. Who are you all talking shit to, anyway? I wave an arm at the group. Because Molly here has fucked half of you. Watch it, Logan warns, and everyone tenses. But instead of arguing with him, I choose to follow after the new girl. I don't know her, but she seems chill, and she's drop-dead gorgeous. Yes, she reminds me of Tessa, and yes, it's taken a long time for me to get over that one. And maybe this is a bad idea, but aren't most things? With all that swirling through my mind, I get up to find her. I didn't mean for the situation with Tessa to become what it did. I cared about her, yes, but I got caught up in my stupid jealousy and petty need for some type of revenge against Hardin for his having sex with Samantha. I did like Tessa a lot, but my feelings for her were nothing close to the way Hardin felt about her. Samantha was amazing. She was fun and a few years older than me. That was a turn-on, but she was wild. Since this thing with Tessa ended, I've often thought her relationship with Hardin was equivalent to what I had with Samantha. But Samantha slept with Hardin and didn't see much of a problem with it. She acted like it was a normal thing to do, to sleep with my friend. He didn't care either, of course. I cared. I was devastated and pissed, and I let it fester inside of me, waiting for the right time to strike back at him. Tessa trusted me, even after my involvement with the bet in the beginning. I was the one who told her the details about it, and she always came to me when she needed me. That was the problem, though. She only came to me when he tossed her to the side, and I'm not about that kind of thing. I don't want to always be second choice. And besides, it was too much drama, and after the initial win of getting under Hardin's skin, it became exhausting to keep running to her rescue and keep up with their childish relationship. I should have left her alone after her psycho boyfriend hit me the first time. But no, his anger only spurred me to keep going and win. Why should he get to sleep with Samantha, then participate in the bet, and then get to decide when everything's okay and settled and the game's over and I have to stop caring? It was all so childish. I can see that now. I shouldn't have tried to come on to her that night at her mom's house, and I shouldn't have said half the shit that I did. My stupidity has kept me single ever since, and I haven't heard from Tessa in over a year. The sad thing is that I miss talking with her. I've been told she moved to New York City with her friend Landon, but I know it won't be long until Hardin follows her there. As much as I hate to admit it, They have something special between them. As dysfunctional as they are, I've never seen two people fight for each other the way those two do. Harden sure as hell doesn't deserve her, but it's not my place to interfere, not anymore. I step outside and scan the yard for Therese, then spy her perched on top of the broken stone wall, bringing another memory to mind. She's picking at the chipped stone, and when I approach her, she moves to jump down. Wait. I hold up my hand and wave it in a gesture of peace. I can help you find your friends, or find someone to give you a ride home. I don't know. She eyes me carefully, watching for hints of a serial killer, maybe. It's only a ride home. My friends are loudmouths, but none of them will hurt you. I'll come along if you wish. I've been drinking, so I can't take you. I raise a brow to her. She shakes her head. Wow, so the cute punk boy does have some common sense. She smiles, mocking me in a sweet way. Sometimes, I admit with a shrug. I reach out to shake her hand. I'm Zed. She hesitates for a moment before reaching for my hand. It's nice to meet you, Zed. She says my name like she's afraid to swallow it. Nice to meet you too, Therese. Landon.
He hated the perfect boy before he even met him. When his dad told him he was getting a new brother, it was like he was expected to be happy about it. He was supposed to suddenly care about things like family and dinners and baked goods so he could keep up with his father's new son. When he met this other child, his hatred only grew. He knew he didn't have a reason beyond pure jealousy to hate him, but still he did. He couldn't name athletes or keep up with sports like his father's new son could, and he couldn't charm the table at a dinner party. He knew he couldn't compete with the boy, but as he changed his life, he realized he'd never really had to. He fought so hard, too hard, to keep his distance from the golden boy, who in the end would become his closest friend.
The first three thoughts that go through my mind each day are, it's less crowded here than I thought. I hope Tessa is off work today so we can hang out. I miss my mom. Yes, I'm a sophomore at New York University, but my mom is one of my best friends. I miss home a lot. It helps to have Tessa around. She's the closest thing to family I have out here. I know college students do this all the time. They leave home and can't wait to be away from their hometowns. But not me. I happen to like mine, even if it's not where I grew up. I had a plan at the time I applied to NYU. It just didn't work out the way it was supposed to. I was supposed to move here and start my future with Dakota, my long-term girlfriend from high school. I had no idea that she would decide she wanted to spend her first year at college single. I was devastated. I still am, but I want her to be happy, even if it's not with me. The city's chilly in September, but there's barely any rain compared to Washington, so that's something at least. As I walk to work, I check my phone, like I do about 50 times a day. My mom's pregnant with my little sister, and I want to be sure that if anything happens, I can get on a plane and be there for her quickly. So far, the only messages from her have been pictures of the amazing things she whips up in the kitchen. Not emergencies, but man, I miss her cooking. The streets are crowded as I make my way through them. I'm waiting at the crosswalk with a crowd of people, mostly tourists with heavy cameras around their necks. I laugh to myself when a teenage boy holds up a giant iPad to take a selfie. I will never understand this impulse. When the light turns yellow and the crosswalk sign starts flashing, I turn up the volume on my headphones. Out here, I pretty much wear headphones all day. The city is so much louder than I had anticipated, and I find it helpful to have something that blocks some of it out, and at least colors those sounds that get in with something I like. Today, it's Hozier. I even wear the headphones while working, in one ear at least, so I can still hear the coffee orders shouted to me. I'm a little distracted today by two men both dressed in pirate outfits and screaming at each other, and as I walk into the shop I bump into Aiden, my least favorite co-worker. He's tall, much taller than me, and he has this white blonde hair that makes him look like Draco Malfoy, so he kind of creeps me out. On top of his Draco resemblance, he happens to be a little rude sometimes. He's nice to me, but I see the way he looks at the college girls who come in to grind. He acts like the coffee shop is named after a club rather than coffee grounds. As he smiles down at them, flirting and making them squirm under his handsome gaze, I find it all pretty off-putting. He's not that handsome, actually. Maybe if he was nicer, I could see it. "Watch it, man," Aiden mumbles, slapping my shoulder like we're crossing a football field together in matching jerseys. He's making record time in annoying me today. But brushing it off, I head into the back and tie my yellow apron around my waist and check my phone. After I clock in, I find Posey, a girl who I'm supposed to be training for a couple of weeks. She's nice, quiet, but she's a hard worker, and I like that she always takes the free cookie we offer her every training day as an incentive to be a little happier during the shift. Most trainees decline it, but she's eaten one every single day this week, sampling the variety, chocolate, chocolate macadamia, sugar, and some mystery greenish flavor that I think is some gluten-free, all-natural, localvore thing. "Hey," I say, smiling at her where she leans against the ice machine. Her hair is tucked behind her ears, and she's reading the back of one of the bags of ground coffee. When she looks up at me, she smiles a quick greeting, then returns her eyes to the bag. "It still makes no sense that they charge $15 for a thing of coffee this small," she says, tossing the bag to me. I barely catch it, and then it nearly slips from my hands, but I grab it tightly. "We," I correct her with a laugh, and sit the bag down on the break table where it came from. "We charge that." "I haven't worked here long enough to be included in the we," she teases, and grabs a hairband off her wrist and lifts her curly reddish-brown hair into the air behind her. It's a lot of hair, and she ties it up neatly, then nods her signal that she's ready to work. Posey follows me out onto the floor and waits by the cash register. She's mastering taking customers' orders this week, and will likely be making the drinks next. I like taking orders the most, because I would rather talk to people than burn my fingers on that espresso machine, like I do every shift. I'm putting everything in order at my station when the bell attached to the door sounds. I look over to Posey to see if she's ready, and sure enough, she's already perked up, all set to greet the morning's caffeine addicts. Two girls approach the counter, chatting loudly. One of the voices strikes me, and I look over at them to see Dakota there. She's dressed in a sports bra, loose shorts, and bright sneakers. She must have just finished a run. If she were leaving for a dance class, she'd be dressed slightly differently. She'd be wearing a one-piece and tighter shorts, and she would look just as good. She always does. Dakota hasn't been in here in a few weeks. I'm surprised to see her now. It makes me nervous, my hands are shaking, and I find myself poking at the computer screen for absolutely no reason. Her friend, Maggie, sees me first. She taps Dakota on her shoulder, and Dakota turns to me, a big smile on her face. Her body is coated in a light layer of sweat, and her black curls are wild in a bun on her head. "I was hoping you'd be working." She waves to me and then to Posey. "She was?" I don't know what to make of this. I know that we agreed to be friends, but I can't tell if this is just friendly chatting or something more. "Hey, Landon." Maggie waves too. I smile at both of them and ask them what they'd like to drink. "Iced coffee, extra cream," the duo says at once. They're dressed nearly identically, but Maggie is easily overshadowed by Dakota's glowing caramel skin and bright brown eyes. I go into automatic mode, grabbing two plastic cups and shoving them into the ice bin with a smooth scooping motion, then pulling up the pitcher of pre-made coffee and pouring it into the cups. Dakota is watching me. I can sense her eyes on me. For some reason, this is making me feel quite awkward, so when I notice that Posey is watching me too, I realize I should, probably, explain to her what the heck I'm doing. "You just pour this over ice. The evening shift makes it the night before so it can get cold and not melt the ice," I say. It's really basic, what I'm telling her, and I almost feel foolish saying it in front of Dakota. We aren't on bad terms at all. We just aren't hanging out and talking like we used to. I completely understood when she ended our 3-year relationship. She was in New York City with new friends and new surroundings. I didn't want to hold her back, so I kept my promise and stayed friends with her. I've known her for years and will always care about her.
She was my second girlfriend, but the first real relationship I've had up to now.
I've been hanging out with So, a woman who's 3 years older than me, though really we're only friends. She's been great to Tessa, too, helping her get a job at the restaurant she works at.
Dakota?
Aiden's voice overpowers mine as I start to ask them if they want me to add whipped cream, something I do to my own drinks. Confused, I watch as Aiden reaches over the counter and grabs Dakota's hand. He lifts their hands into the air, and with a big smile, she twirls in front of him. Then, taking a glance at me, she inches away just a bit and says more neutrally,
"I didn't know you worked here."
I look at Posey to distract myself from eavesdropping on their conversation, then pretend like I'm looking at the schedule on the wall behind her. It's really none of my business who she has friendships with.
"I thought I mentioned it last night," Aiden says, and I cough to distract everyone from the noise I just made.
Fortunately, no one seems to notice except Posey, who tries her best to hide her smile. I don't look at Dakota, even though I can sense she's uncomfortable. In reply to Aiden, she laughs the laugh she gave my grandma upon opening her Christmas gift last year. That cute noise. Dakota made my grandma so happy when she laughed at the cheesy singing fish plastered to a fake wooden plank. When she laughs again, I know she's really uncomfortable now. Wanting to make this whole situation less awkward, I hand her the two coffees with a smile and tell her I hope to see her soon. Before she can answer, I smile once more and walk to the back room, turning the sound up on my headphones. I wait for the bell to ring again, signaling Dakota and Maggie's exit, and realize that I probably won't hear it over yesterday's hockey game playing in my ear. Even with only one bud in, the cheering of the crowd and slaps of the sticks would overpower an old brass bell. I go back out to the floor and find Posey rolling her eyes at Aiden as he shows off his milk steaming skills to her. He looks weird with a cloud of steam in front of his white blonde hair.
"He said they're in school together at that dance academy he goes to," Posey whispers when I approach.
I freeze and look toward Aiden, who is oblivious, lost in his own apparently glorious world.
"You asked him?" I say,
impressed and a little worried about what his answers would be to other questions involving Dakota. Posey nods, grabbing a metal cup to rinse. I follow her to the sink, and she turns on the hose.
"I saw the way you acted when he held her hand, so I thought I'd just ask what was going on with them."
She shrugs, and her big mass of curly hair moves. Her freckles are lighter than most I've seen and are scattered across the tops of her cheeks and the bridge of her nose. Her lips are big, they pout a tad, and she's nearly my height. These were things I noticed on her third day of training, when I suppose my interest flared up for a moment. "I dated her for a while," I admit to my new friend, and hand her a towel to dry the cup with.
"Oh, I don't think they're dating. She would be insane to date a Slytherin."
When Posey smiles, my cheeks flare and I laugh along with her. "You noticed it too?" I ask. Reaching between us, I grab a pistachio mint cookie and offer it to her. She smiles, taking the cookie from my hand and eating half of it before I even manage to get the lid back on the bin.
Christian. The connections we have with family are supposed to be soul-binding. We're supposed to love our parents and siblings and the rest simply because we are born with the same blood running through our veins. As a young child, he would question this. Was he supposed to love the stumbling man whose loud voice regularly woke him up on school nights? The man whom he would walk out into the living room and see there, leaning against the fireplace mantel in a struggle to take his boots off? The little boy would keep his body hidden behind the wall as he watched the man struggle and fall to the floor. Then he would hurry back to his room as the man's boot hit the wall near his head. He hated those nights, and he would count the days until his mummy's friend, who laughed a lot, would come over. He would wish that his mum's friend was his dad. Maybe this other man would take him places, he used to think. He remembered the man always carrying a book tucked under his arm. He talked about the books with the boy, telling him their plots, their themes, making him feel smart and grown up. The first book the man gifted him, he will always remember. That book quickly became the boy's first real friend, and as he grew older and his mum's friend came around less and less, he remembered missing him and missing the books during the long periods between visits. Still, even into the boy's rebellious teenage years, when the man arrived, he always had books with him. The boy knew his mum loved her friend, but he had no idea just how much of his life was a lie because of that fact. The house is silent. I glance over at Kim, asleep on the couch with Karina lying on her stomach. The girl's little hands are gripping her mum's sweater. Kim fell asleep talking to her about me and my accent, telling our little girl that she will have the most adorable voice, a mixture of mummy's sweet tones and daddy's devilish accent. Devilish, she called it, as if the woman can afford to talk. She's the most stubborn, devilish woman on this earth, and I love the hell out of her. Kimberly has gone from being my secretary to my business partner, and she has quite an eye for potential. Perhaps that's why she married me. Or maybe she just really, really likes my son, Smith. It would be pretty hard not to. A pile of pages sits before me on the counter. A contract for the New York restaurant will be opening in the next year. As exciting as it is, it's nothing compared to my newborn. I've now expanded my investments in restaurants from Washington to New York to Los Angeles, but it's nothing compared to the joy of getting to see this girl grow up before my eyes, something I've not been fortunate enough to have done with my other children. I glance over at my wife again, snoring louder than usual. So I do the sweet, loving thing and pull out my phone to record her. The contract can wait until tomorrow. I miss my wife. I watch her as she takes breath. The noise is horrendous. I press record and quietly walk over to the couch. Within 5 seconds, she opens her eyes, immediately glaring at the phone in my hand, and instantly I feel like an arse for disrupting her sleep when she gets so little of it anymore.
Aren't you supposed to be working?
My love whispers, her voice soft and sleepy as she stretches her arm above her head, keeping her eyes on Karina. Yes, my dear, but fucking with you is much more fun. I laugh, and she kicks her foot out at me. Karina stirs on her chest, opening her little beady eyes to look up at her obnoxious parents.
Now you've done it.
Kimberly scolds me with a smile. She sits up and lifts Karina at the same time, and when I reach for my daughter, she gently places the soft bundle in my arms.
My beautiful little girl,
I quietly say to Karina, nudging her chubby little cheek with my nose. She yawns, and I see so much of my smile in her face. Smith and Harden both have that same dimpled smile. I remember Anne and Ken discussing names for the little boy one night when we were all standing around in their kitchen. Trish's belly had been so swollen that she couldn't tie her shoes. I like the name Nicholas or Harold, Ken had suggested.
Harold? No. Nicholas? Double no.
Trish had smiled softly, rubbing her hand on her bump.
Harold, I kind of like that.
Admittedly, I didn't hate the name. It just didn't feel right. That boy was tough on Trish's body, kicking her all night and growing so quickly that he stretched her skin to incredible lengths. He was a fighter, that kid. The name Harold. Harry. It was too sweet of a name. Too calm. It's too common, I'd interjected before Ken could say anything. How about the name Harden? It was a name I had picked out for my first child while I was only a teen. As a little boy in Hampstead, I used to think I was going to write a great novel one day, and the main character would be named Harden. Not typical, but very convincing sounding for old England. Trish sounded it out to see how it felt on her tongue.
Harden. I'm not sure.
But when she looked to her husband, who I was so jealous of in that instant, he just shrugged, uninterested but trying to be courteous. "It sounds fine," he'd said quietly. His shoulders did another shrug, and Trish smiled a weak smile.
"Harden? Harden!"
"There we have it, then," Ken declared, looking very relieved. Trish didn't seem surprised, or even bothered by his mild reaction to the choosing of their first son's name. I cared, though, and I knew Trish really did as well. I would like to think that Ken would normally have cared, but he was in college and always busy, I had reasoned at the time. He studied so much, and rumors flew that he'd started snorting the devil's candy while studying for his law exams. His pupils were usually dilated, but he had to study a lot, and I got that. I wasn't anyone to judge him, but I knew he had been slipping on the facade of being a perfect dad to the little guy, trying it on uncertainly, long before the tyke was even here yet. That bothered me more than it should have, given the situation I'd gotten myself into. 2 decades ago. The sun is hot, blazing for Hampstead in April. Trish lies beside me on the grass, the wind whipping her thick brown hair across my face, which she found to be the most entertaining moment of her entire 16 years in this world. Most of the time she's mature for her age, going on and on about her theories about the world and its leaders. But in this moment she's choosing to be the 11-year-old version of herself. I push her hair away from my face for the 10th time. "Weren't you supposed to be cutting that gargantuan mane?" I ask cheekily as I scoot my body a few inches away from hers. Last week she claimed that she was planning to cut all of her hair off to prove some point, but I forget what that point actually was. Hampstead Town Park is nearly empty today, so Trish's laugh echoes off the trees enclosing us in the grass. We come here often, but most of the time Ken misses our meetings because he's so busy.
"I was considering it, but this is too much fun," she replies.
Trish rolls her body closer to mine and throws her brown hair across my face once more. It smells like flowers and a little bit like mint. It's a scent that always pulls me in. Her body is pressed to my side, and she kicks her leg up over mine. I should move it, but I don't. It feels too nice there.
"What if babies were born with long hair?"
Her question is random, but not one bit surprising. Trish Powell is known for her questions. "What if this? What if that?" It's her thing, and I find it equal parts weird and cool. She's so different from all the girls at my school. Even the girls at the local university aren't like her. Her wild hair was the first thing I noticed when I met her, and now it's become the biggest problem in my Tuesday afternoon. Did we really skip class to talk about babies coming out of their mum's bodies with rocker hair? I ask. I open my eyes and roll onto my stomach to get a good look at her. She has so many freckles. I want to connect them with my fingertips and watch her eyes flutter closed in delight.
"No, I suppose not,"
she giggles, and I follow her eyes to the shadow approaching us. Ken sits down on the grass, and I watch his eyes change from the moon to the sun as he studies Trish's face. She smiles back at him, and Ken looks like he's won the lottery as he makes his way through the tall grass. I can't tell if she notices the way he looks at her. I've always noticed it, and gotten used to pretending it doesn't burn like acid through my veins. It's common knowledge that of the two of us, he's the better man. The sun is becoming too hot on my skin, and I stand, shading my eyes with one hand. "I'm going to head out. I have a date," I say, and wipe my hands on my jean shorts. Seeing their brown hue against the faded denim, I again marvel how I've gotten quite the tan over the summer. Trish mentions it almost daily. It must be from hanging out with her so much. Trish rolls her eyes and mouths something rather dirty to both of us. Ken flushes just a little in the apples that are his cheeks, His hair is growing long, looking ratty where it starts to cover the back of his neck. There are dark bags under his brown eyes from studying like a madman to prepare for his entry exam into law school. Ken Scott is the most stable student in Trish's and my entire level. I have no idea how someone like him ended up becoming our best friend. I suppose Trish is a tad more stable than me. She's firecrackers and sunshine, but she's also cool stone and steady waves. She knows when to cut loose and when to be cautious and smart. I've always loved that about her. "Can I talk to you for a minute?" Ken says when I stand. He comes a little closer to me. He's taller than me by a few inches. I nod, waiting for him to begin, but then seeing his eyes focus on Trish, I catch on that he means alone and gesture for him to lead the way. I follow him for about 20 meters, at which point he stops next to an old metal bench. He sits first and pats the empty space next to him. He's acting so serious. Should I be worried? A young couple walks past us, their hands linked together. Ken waits for them to pass, and my worry to rise before he finally speaks.
"I wanted to talk to you about something," he says.
His brows draw down, making him look much older than 17.
"You're not dying, are you?"
I push my shoulder into his, and he relaxes a fraction. He shakes his head.
No, it's not that."
The noise he makes is half laugh, half nervous titter. What could he be so tense about? I wish he would just spit it out.
"I want to ask Trish to be mine,"
he breathes out in one long syllable. Now I wish I could cram the words back inside his anxious face, or that maybe he was dying. Okay, not something so harsh, but something else. Anything else.
"To be your..."
"What?" I struggle to keep my composure. Ken's eyes roll.
"My girl, you twat."
I want to tell him that he can't have her, that it isn't fair that he's the one who gets to ask her first. "Give her a choice," I want to tell him. "She was always supposed to be mine," I want to argue.
"Why are you telling me?"
comes out instead. My friend sits back against the bench and rests his palms against his knees.
"I just wanted to make sure,"
he starts, but the words are trapped behind his tongue. And in that sudden silence, I realize I'm caught between being honest with my best friend and making him happy. It's impossible to do both. I break into a smile, choosing his happiness over mine. I'm not surprised when Trish accepts Ken's offer, but I would be lying if I said I didn't hold on to some fraction of hope that maybe she loves me, too. She loves stability more, though, and so for the next year, I avoid every thought of Trish being anything other than my best mate's girlfriend. Sometimes when they kiss in front of me, I catch her looking at me for approval after they've pulled away from each other. I keep that little morsel of hope alive, and it makes my year a very rough one. When I fuck, I think of her. When I kiss, I taste her. I have to stop. It's an easy task at first. I stop comparing all the girls I date to her. She stops slipping her hand through mine when we're talking. I begin to see the world differently now that I no longer think of her as a tether to home. She's no longer keeping me here. Nothing is. I've outgrown Hampstead. I know it. Trish knows it. Even the local bakery has grown suspicious of my recent behavior, and the fact that my weekly trips to buy sweets there have tapered down to nothing. Suddenly I crave more of this world than living in this town. I want to move to the States, away from the daft minds of my mates who have no plans for their futures, and even farther away from my two favorite lovers. I've quickly become a fifth wheel with Ken and Max and their ladies. I want to learn more about the world, about people in general, and I can't settle down here. Everyone around me has their roots firmly planted here already. They've opened up bank accounts and chosen a local university. I can already foresee their ambition short-circuiting when they take their first job doing what one of their parents did. They settle into these roles and never audition for any others. Trish has become one of them. She's gone from being an excited liberal arts major to barely attending her classes. She and Ken moved into a small apartment across from the campus of his school to save travel time. He's a mess lately, working so much. Every time I see him, he's behind a stack of textbooks. Trish is less of a lover and more of a mother to him now. She sets his alarm clock every evening. She makes sure his clothes are clean and laid out on their bed in the morning. She makes his coffee, his breakfast, packs his lunch. She waits for him to get home. She feeds him a hot meal and is ignored in favor of his books. And then the next day, the same tedious cycle repeats all over again. She's no longer the vibrant, risk-taking flower child she once was. She's the overworked and underslept waiting woman. Because of her efforts, their apartment is as clean as it is small, and she's managed to charm up the place. Trish has even taken in a stray kitten and named it Gat, after one of my favorite characters. I suspect Ken doesn't care for the creature, or the name she chose. Her what-if games that I enjoyed on the hill become less and less frequent every day, and more of what she expresses can be called free-floating anxiety. She no longer indulges in flights of fancy that entertain us both. Instead, she worries about minute things, and I'm no longer a playmate in a grassy field, but someone who has to reassure her, even though I'm not the first in her heart. Even through this, though, she still keeps her humor, and I pray to God each night that she won't lose it completely. The more often I stop by, the brighter she seems to burn. I make it a point to stop by weekly, then twice a week, as she asks me to do. The hours Ken's gone become longer, leaving their home emptier. She shares with me her worries and whispers her darkest questions into the dark room. I pretend to have all the answers, and like a good friend to them both, I encourage her to share her fears with her lover. Quickly, I regret this decision. One night, a rare night when Ken is at home and not studying, we're all sitting around the kitchen table, each of us with a glass of whiskey in hand. During a lull in the awkward conversation, in which we try to catch up with one another's recent life, Ken refills his glass. He doesn't bother to look for ice. He never does anymore. Trish sighs loudly and gets up, only to go into their small living room and sit on the arm of their couch.
What if the whole world exists in a glass case inside some alien child's bedroom, like an ant farm of sorts?
I swear Trish's accent grows deeper each time she drinks.
What a fucked up question,
I snort, the whiskey burning in my nostrils. Ken doesn't break a smile. His lips don't even make the slightest upturn. I get up to stretch, to not be the only one sitting at the table with him.
Fine. What if the world ends tomorrow, proving that we all are wasting our time working so hard and sleeping so little?
Her eyes are light in the dim room. Gat climbs up onto her lap, and she runs her fingers through his burnt orange fur. I begin to think through her question. If I died tomorrow, would she know how much I ache for her? How much I love her? Ken finally laughs, but his comment is not what I expected.
Working hard! As if you know anything about that.
He's smiling now, head tilting back in a sinister way as he leans over the table. Gat seems to sense the threat as Trish takes in a deep breath. I've never seen them fight, but if they do, my money is on Trish. The cat jumps down and prances off into the hallway. I should follow it. I should leave and stay out of this, but I can't. Ken lifts his glass to his lips and gulps down the remainder of the brown liquor in his tumbler.
I'm sorry. I couldn't possibly have heard that correctly,
Trish says through her teeth.
I ignore the way my hands shake under the table when he stands up and starts raising his voice. I ignore my instinct to tackle him and shake him until he wakes up from the sleepwalking state he's been slipping into lately. A state in which he starts yelling at her, calling her terrible names, saying terrible things about her. I ignore the way my stomach feels like surging lava when she slaps him across the face. I ignore the way her tears burn through the flesh of my arms as I hold her on the couch after he's been gone for 30 minutes, drunk as a fish and out driving somewhere, even though he's incapable of walking straight. But after the way he stormed out of here, not bothering to turn around when I called after him, I'm glad he's gone.
What if he doesn't come back?
Trish's lips tremble as she finally starts to calm down, her head on my chest. And what if he does? I ask her. She sighs and squeezes my hand between hers. I look down at her face. My heart aches. She's so beautiful, even when her lips are red from chewing at them, and her eyes are swollen from wetting them with her tears. She's calm now, her eyes stuck on my lips.
What if I'm losing sight of the man I thought I knew?
Trish's question comes out quickly, her next even more so.
What if I would rather have attention than a stable life?
She seems frantic now, pushing her fingers through her thick brown hair. She faces me, squaring off her shoulders.
What if I confused friendship with love? Do you think Ken and I did that?
She looks down at my hands, which are reaching for her without having realized it. I don't know, I say, pulling my hands back to run them over my hair, and then sitting back against the couch. I confused friendship and love when I chose friendship over my feelings for Trish, but now my best friends have made a life together. The problem they face isn't a lack of love. It's a lack of time. That's all. He loves her, and if she loved me rather than him, she would have told me long before now. She moves onto her knees on the couch, just to reach me. Her hand moves to my hair, and she pushes it back for me.
What if it's not that simple?
Can she sense how I feel for her? Is that why she's moving closer and closer with every rise of her chest? When her face is only an inch from mine, she looks me straight in the eyes.
Do you ever think of me?
The whiskey on both of our breaths hangs in the air, even though both of us had far less to drink than Ken. There I go mentioning Ken again. It's like his presence is everywhere in this apartment. He marked Trish's body as his. He lies with her every night. He gets to feel her breasts under his palms. He gets to touch the pale skin on her stomach, her thighs. Her lips touch him. He tastes her. And I never will. I shouldn't, I say. But I would be a fool not to think of her slender hips and perfect skin. I watched her grow up, and fantasizing about her was a daily, constant thing. Trish is pleased by my answer. I can see it in the way she licks her lips while staring at mine, the way her mouth is slightly open. Does this mean she's been having thoughts about me? Why else would she ask? When her eyes flicker to my eyes, then back to my mouth, common sense and self-restraint are no longer in my vocabulary, and I wrap